I had some notes for a little talk I was going to give this morning before we went into the readings. And then this morning, I left the notes and decided I didn't like them. So I'm going to wing it. So this sounds like a winged talk. I don't like it. The topic for the weekend is the fourth frame of reference. Now, this is part of Buddha's teachings on developing mindfulness. Yes, basically four frames of reference in which you develop mindfulness. Ways in which to establish mindfulness, or places to establish mindfulness, frames of reference, basically frames of reference to keep in mind. Because that is what mindfulness is all about, is keeping something in mind. We'll talk about this a little bit more as we go through the day. There's a common misunderstanding of mindfulness as just being basically barely aware. Aware, barely. It's kind of accepting things as they come and go. But when the Buddha's talking about mindfulness, very definitely it's a quality of your memory. It's your ability to keep something in mind. And specifically, keeping in mind what you should be doing. Now, your shoulds can come from lots of different places. But in the context of the path, the should is, what can you do to help put an end to suffering? Basically, how to understand suffering, dukkha, which can also be translated as stress. What you can do to understand it, what you can do to figure out what the cause is, and then what you can do to put an end to the cause. So that's what you're trying to keep in mind. That's the general frame that the mindfulness is supposed to keep in mind. It's part of a larger path, which includes everything from right view to right concentration. We'll be getting into that as well as we go today. But of these four frames of reference, the first is the body. Keep your body in mind, in other words, or it's staying in the present moment. Stay grounded in your sense of the body in the present moment. And then you can be aware of feelings as they arise and pass away, and or mental states as they arise and pass away. Feelings of not so much emotions, some more feelings of pleasure or pain. When you have pleasure or pain, it's more like a feeling tone. And then your mind states. Any of those you can keep in mind to say, I've got to stay with this, and then figure out what to do with these things. Because each of these things is something that you actually do. You're involved in the creation of these things all the time. We tend to think of ourselves as being passively aware of these things. In other words, they come into our awareness and then we have to react one way or another. But one of the Buddha's insights in the course of his exploration of the issue of pain and suffering is the extent to which we shape our experience. The mind is primarily active. When he describes dependent core arising, which is his description of how we create suffering, factors of intention and what he calls fabrication come even before you've received any input from the senses at all. Before you've looked at something, you've already got something in mind. You've already begun to fabricate how you're going to be experiencing this, how you're going to be looking at this. The same with all the other senses. So your mind is primarily active, and what it needs, of course, is directions and how to act skillfully, because as he found also that the main cause of our suffering is the way we fabricate our experience, the way we put it together. And what we need is some new instructions. Okay, if you're going to face a particular experience, what do you keep in mind? What instructions do you keep in mind? What's a good way to deal with a particular quality of mind, body, or feeling as they arise? How do you shape these things so that they don't lead to suffering? The word fabrication here, it's sankhara in Pali, actually refers to three different processes. One is a physical process of the way you breathe. And this is one of the reasons why breath meditation is the basic topic in most meditation sessions, is that just by the way you breathe, you're affecting your experience of your body. You breathe heavily for about 15 minutes and you can pass out. You can hold your breath for 15 minutes and pass out. Your experience of the body really does depend a lot on the breath. And the breath is one of the few processes in the body over which you have some control. There's an intentional element that goes into your breathing. Second type of fabrication the Buddha talked about is verbal fabrication, basically the way you talk to yourself. What you're talking about, if you had a recording of what you say to yourself in the course of the day. You know, they tried to replicate that in stream of consciousness novels, and it's pretty crazy. And for most of us, you wouldn't want other people to see what was going through your mind. And then the third is what the book called feelings and perceptions. Now, feelings again, feeling tones. your mental state is very much shaped by the feeling tone that you carry around. And to some extent, that's something you passively receive. And some, to another extent, it's something you actually shape. You can shape the way you focus on a particular feeling and emphasize either something positive in your experience or emphasize something negative. Years back, after I had some experience meditating, I was involved in a psych experiment. They didn't know I had a meditation background. And the experiment was basically to stick your hand in a bucket of cold water with ice. And there were three different groups, and the three different groups were told different things. The first group was told, pull your hand out as soon as it gets unbearable. The second group was told, keep your hand in there as long as you can. The third group was told, think of the cold in your cold hand going to the other hand, and the warmth in the other hand going back to warm up the hand in the ice. See how long you can keep it in there. And so I was just sitting there, and I've been doing breath meditation. It was great, this is no problem at all. And after about 5 minutes, they said, you can stop now. And it turned out, we weren't told ahead of time which group we were going to be in. In fact, we weren't even told the purpose of the experiment at all. But what they found out, of course, is that you can focus on certain sensations and really intensify them. Or they can be there and you can basically not intensify them at all. So a lot of this has to do with your feelings that you're carrying around have a lot to do with your own input, what you're going to focus on, what you see as important. The other mental fabrications with something called perception, sanya in Pali. And these are the labels you put on things. They can either be verbal labels, like good, 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 or just be a visual label. You see something and it reminds you of something else, you know, your lizard brain responds. Your boss is yelling at you and you see tiger. Mm-hmm. Or you see something that you can take advantage of and you see mouse. These perceptions really control how we deal with other people and how we shape our experience. And as the Buddha pointed out, as he was explaining this in Dependent Core Arising, is if you do this with ignorance, you're going to suffer. In fact, everything that's fabricated has some element of stress in it, but we tend to do it with an extra element, which is the clinging. Again, this is something we'll be talking about as we go through the weekend, what clinging is. It compounds the suffering. And it turns out the suffering that comes from the clinging is the one that actually weighs the mind down. The pain and suffering that comes from things outside doesn't really weigh the mind down. It's the clinging where we pull these things in, how we go out to shape our experience and pull things back in. That's actually the big problem. That's the suffering in the Four Noble Truths. You may have heard of suffering and the three characteristics in the Four Noble Truths. There are two different types of suffering that the Buddha is talking about. And the three characteristics he's talking about is simply about the stress of things arising and passing away. Everything that depends on conditions is unstable and will eventually have to fall away. That's normal. The reason that weighs down on our mind, though, is the stress, is the suffering that comes from craving and clinging. We pull these things in, try to make them ours, try to control them, try to have them be a certain way, and it's not that certain way. The mind suffers. It's important when you realize when the Buddha's talking about suffering here, it's not talking about misfortune. The Buddha's not talking about let's go out and feed the hungry or do things outside. Each of us is creating this suffering for ourselves, this level of suffering that weighs the mind down. And it's on the level of experience. Think for a minute back when you were a child, and you suddenly realize, you know, when you look at the color blue, and other people look at the color blue, do you see the same thing? Is your blue the same thing as my blue? And we can point to John's shirt over there and agree that yes, it is blue. But what do you see when you see blue? And we can't take these things out and compare them. You can't look at somebody else's blue. It's something each of us experiences for ourselves alone. And in philosophy, they call this phenomenology, what your experience is. You're just the raw material of your experience as you experience it. Now, the question of John's shirt being blue, whether your blue is the same as my blue, that's not just kind of a point of curiosity. But suffering, which is another thing that happens on this level of experience, that's not just a curiosity, that really is a problem. Nobody else can get in and see your suffering. You can't get in and see anybody else's suffering. You can see the effects, but you can't feel somebody else's suffering. And this is the problem that the Buddha wants you to focus on. It's the suffering you're creating for yourself here on this level. This is what not only makes you miserable, but also causes you to behave in an unskillful way, or speak in unskillful ways that lead to other people to get troubled by you as well. That's the level that he's focusing on. Now, one of there are two problems that come from this. One is when the Buddha said he put an end to suffering. Can we see it? Mm-hmm. All we can do is take his word for it. He looked like a kind of responsible person that you could believe. Mm-hmm. I've always wondered about, you know, suppose somebody came up to you along the street and said, "Hey, I'm the Son of God." Another person came up to you and said, "I can put an end to suffering." Now, which person would you be less likely to think is crazy? But even then, you wouldn't have any proof. You don't know. You have to look at his behavior. Fortunately, the Buddha says it's not just that he could do that, but he can also teach a way to the end of suffering. That's something we can try. And so on the one hand, you have to take his... There has to be a certain amount of faith in that this makes sense, what he's saying here, and it's a possibility. Let's give it a try. But then to prove it, you have to actually follow the practice yourself. The second problem we run into, and we'll run into this a little bit more as the weekend goes on, is that when you're talking on this level of, you know, how you experience blue or how you experience orange or whatever, we don't have much of a vocabulary. Our language is things that we agree on, the kind of conventions that we agree on, but we can't point to somebody's, you know, the sweater here and say, "This is green, and is your green the same as my green?" Well, how would you describe your green? You say, "Well, it's green." That's about as far as you can get. But the Buddha is trying to give you a vocabulary for looking into this level of your experience to understand, okay, when you feel suffering, what exactly is going on? And the vocabulary is going to be a little bit strange because we're not used to talking on that level, like when the Buddha is talking about aggregates and that kind of stuff. It's not the first thing that pops into your mind. It's an acquired taste, let's put it that way, so you remember. You learn a new vocabulary. I personally never liked the word aggregate. It sounds like a pile of gravel. But we make good use of what we got. So what we're doing here is taking on his instructions on how you put an end to this level of suffering, because this is the big problem in life. And that's another thing that you have to take in. Do you agree with him that is this a big problem, or are there other problems that are bigger? And he's pointing out that it's a big problem because once you solve this problem, there are no more problems. Mm-hmm. Every problem comes down to the fact that on one level we create suffering around it. So let's learn how not to create suffering around things. And then we deal with the rest of the world as it comes. So agreeing on the importance of this issue is an important part of the practice. Once you've agreed that, okay, this is important, the fact that I'm suffering here, then a number of tasks come about. This is what the Buddha's Four Noble Truths are all about. He says you have to look at the suffering as a result of an action. Now that right there has several variables. One is there's the action and then there's the result. And then he's saying there are skillful actions and unskillful actions because there are desirable results and undesirable results. That's the framework for the Four Noble Truths. The first noble truth of suffering is an undesirable result. The second noble truth, cause of craving, which is the cause of suffering, that's an unskillful action. You call it karma, or on the more subtle level, you can say it's a fabrication, it's unskillful. As for the path, that's a skillful action, and the cessation of suffering is the desirable result. So we're going to be dealing in dualities here. But the useful dualities. You go into an operating room, you're going to operate on your brain, you want to make sure the surgeon knows the left side of your brain and the right side of your brain. These are some good dualities to know. And, you know, if you're not interested in seeing that suffering is a problem, okay, then you don't have to take on these dualities. But if you see it is a problem, you have to start thinking, okay, right, what's the action that I want to do? Can I see myself doing unskillful actions, and can I learn how to change things? Because what eventually we'll get to, it'll be what the Buddha calls a dimension in the mind, ayatana, which is unfabricated. There's something in which you haven't put together, there's no intentional element, it's not created by conditions in any way at all. That, he says, is where suffering ends. It's something that can be touched, but you don't get there simply by saying, okay, I'm just not going to do anything, I'm just going to chill out and vegetate. Because there's a lot of levels of fabrication going in your mind that you're not conscious of. And it's only in the course of the path that you get more and more conscious of these levels of what am I doing that's adding to the suffering here? What am I doing that's weighing the mind down? So there's an element of paradox in the path, is that you give up, you get to the end of fabrication first by learning how to fabricate skillfully. How do you speak? How do you act? How do you think? How do you breathe? How do you talk to yourself? How do you, what feelings do you give rise to? What perceptions do you hold to? How do you fabricate these things in a way that's going to become a path to the other suffering? Now, because these things are actions, think about when you're acting in a particular way, it's, you're relating to all three time periods at once. You're focusing on what's there in the present moment. You try to remember, well, what did I do in the past that was helpful? And if I can't think of anything that I did in the past that was helpful, what can I make up? Kind of making things up on the fly. And this is also for the purpose of the future. I want to do this in a way that will lead to good results in the future. Every action is deals in these terms. And so what the Buddha is providing, as he gives you a teaching on all of this, is good things to remember. Good things to hold in mind. In the Eightfold Path, you might look at this kind of a checklist. How are my actions? How's my speech? What's my effort like right now? And you hold this in mind because the framework gives you directions on what to do. And with the Four Noble Truths, there are four duties, one per truth. The first one, suffering or stress, is something that you want to comprehend. That means you want to understand, okay, what's going on here? And most of us, that's not our gut reaction to suffering. We're going to push it away. But the Buddha says, before you can't push this thing away, but you can comprehend it so you can understand where the cause is coming from. Once you see where the cause is coming from, the duty with regard to the cause is to abandon it. You stop it. You let it go. Now, in terms of the mind, when you say letting go, it's not like you've got a hand of the mind that's holding on to something, but you've got a habit that you keep repeating. You have a habitual way of acting a certain way, a habitual way of thinking, feeling, perceiving, talking to yourself. And you've got to catch yourself in the action of doing that. Because again, some of these things are conscious, a lot of it is unconscious until you get your mind really, really still. You can see what's going on. Once you see that cause, you abandon it. The path, which is the set of qualities that will allow you to see these things, allow you to abandon the cause of suffering, is something you develop. There are things you work on, things that you try to build up. And as for the cessation of suffering, that's something you want to realize. Once you see, okay, the suffering has fallen away, you know the suffering has stopped. So you have four different duties. And it's important to keep this in mind. And the Buddha said, this is the main framework that you want to apply to everything. If you're interested in putting it into suffering, this is the framework you apply. So you can figure out, what do I need to do right now? All too often, we hear sort of the one task path, i.e. let go. And there are some things that are worth letting go, and other things that you don't let go. You take the image of the raft. They talk about the path being a raft that'll take you across the river. We all know that when you get across the river to the other side, you let go of the raft. You don't carry it around on your head. But when you're on the river, you don't let go. Otherwise, it's going to be trouble. And John Cha has a nice story. He tells you, suppose you're coming back from the market, you've got a banana in your hand. And someone asks you, what are you going to do with the banana? He says, I'm going to eat it. You eat the peel? No. Then why are you carrying the peel? And he says, how are you going to answer? And it's interesting. He says, you answer through desire. You want to give it. You want to give an answer. It's the desire that's going to give rise to the answer. And the answer is, I need the peel right now to hold it so it doesn't get mushy in my hands. Now when the time comes, I will let the peel go. But not yet. But it's interesting that he focused on the desire first. Basically, he's making a point about desire on the path. You've got to have desire. In fact, it's one of the elements of right effort. You have to have the desire to put it into something. You have to see that it really is something important. You can't say, well, I'm not beyond all dualities right now. I'm just going to let go and do whatever. It doesn't work. Mm-hmm. There's certain things you've got to hold on to. So one of these things you hold on to is these frames of reference. When the Buddha gives you things to keep in mind as you're going along the path. Places to focus your awareness, places to, and questions that you ask yourself about what's going on. This is the purpose of these frames of reference. The body as a frame of reference, its main purpose is to keep you there in the present moment. When you're with the breath, You're not in the past, you're not in the future, because you can't watch a past breath and you can't watch a future breath. You're there with the present breath right now. Similarly with feelings. You're with a particular feeling. You can't feel yesterday's pain. You can feel the memory of yesterday's pain, but you can't feel yesterday's pain. And similarly with your mind states. When you're with a particular mind state, you know you're there. Now the problem with mind states, of course, is that you tend to spin off into a particular mental world, which is why the body is the prime foundation. And again, it's not just a matter of just being there. There are certain things you do. You look at the Buddha's instructions on breath, and he's basically telling you things to do when you're with the breath, like we did just now. Be aware of the variations in the breath, try to be aware of the whole body. And then he says, the step we did get to this morning, which is calming bodily fabrication, that was calm the breath down. Calm down the effect it has on the body. Similarly with feelings. He doesn't say just watch feelings as they come and go. Try to notice, is this a feeling that's based on sensuality, or is this a feeling that's based on my desire to go to the end of the path, go to the end of suffering? Because it's the second ones that are the ones that you're trying to develop. You actually develop. There's a certain pain that comes from being on the path, i.e., I've got work to do and it's not done. And the Buddha doesn't tell you to abandon that. He says, remember that. Keep that in mind. Learn how to deal with it in a mature way. How do you do that? Well, you say, let's try to develop the sense of well-being that can come from being on the path. This is one of the functions of concentration practice. Try to get a sense of pleasure going and then try to maintain that sense of pleasure. Don't just say, oh, there's pleasure coming, and it's going, and that's it. See, it's there, okay, let's keep it going. And you learn a lot about the mind. Of course, the first thing that happens when you see the pleasure is, grab for it, and it goes away. The second time around, it's okay. The last time, that wasn't right, it didn't work. How can I maintain the sense of pleasure? And you learn it has something to do with the way you breathe, it has to do with the way you perceive things, all these elements of fabrication that we're talking about. Similarly with mind states. You see a skillful mind state arise, you don't just let it come and go. You want to keep it going. Unskillful mind states come, you want to get rid of them. Now you find, okay, just trying to wish them away is not going to happen. You learn how what works. When greed arises, how can I effectively get rid of the greed? When lust arises, when anger arises, how do I effectively do this? Now these are skills. So these are the skills with regard to body, feelings, and mind. Dhammas, which is the topic for this week, is basically frameworks for helping keep in mind how you classify what's coming up in your experience so that you can know what to do with it. That right there is the message of the weekend. If you have any place you've got to go this weekend, you got the message. We'll be exploring that for the rest of the week. The Buddha is giving you a framework to keep in mind so you know, what do I do when things come up? And the different frameworks are going to be useful in different aspects of your practice. One of the frameworks is the sixth sense media, i.e., think of just being aware of the fact that something is, you've got the eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, mind, you've got objects of these things. Learn how to see things just on the level of that framework. The Buddha, for example, says, when when somebody's yelling at you, what do you think to yourself? An unpleasant sound is making contact at the ear. I don't know about you, but that's not the first thing that usually comes to my mind. But he says, if you look at it from that perspective, then you know what to do with it. He said, okay, just leave it there at the ear. Don't bring it into the mind to get the mind all worked up about it. Because we're not just aware of the fact that we have these things, we're also aware that the mind relates to these things in ways that ties itself down. You get tied down to passion, you get tied down to anger. By the way, you normally react to sight, sound, smells, taste, tactile sensations. But if you can keep in mind, okay, that's just a sound, that's just a sight. And then you notice, okay, what am I doing with reaction to that? Then you turn and look at that. And the Buddha gives you instructions with this, how you deal with that response coming up. Of course, it's not just the response. Sometimes you're out looking for trouble. And this is why we have porn sites on the internet. They don't just suddenly pop on your screen. Although I'm told nowadays they do sometimes. This is also why we have hate radio. I mean, people don't just, you know, the radio doesn't turn itself on. You're going down, you're stuck in traffic going into Seattle, and you say, let's listen to some Rush Limbaugh. Add some fuel to the fire. A lot of times the mind is out there looking for trouble, so you have to ask yourself, when I'm looking, why am I looking? When I'm listening, why am I listening? What am I listening for? Who's doing the listening? Is greed doing the listening? Is anger doing the listening? So the six-fold sense media, that's the formal topic. That's there for how you go through the day, and so you can notice what's coming up in your mind and giving you a framework for how to deal with it right away. As you're walking around and doing working and whatever. Two of the frameworks have to do with concentration practice, so the five hindrances and the seven factors for waiting. The five hindrances are things you want to get rid of so you can get the mind to settle down. The seven factors of awakening are actually qualities you want to develop so the mind can settle down and have good solid concentration. So those are two frameworks that you're going to be keeping in mind as you're doing your formal meditation, getting into concentration. The five aggregates are primarily for developing discernment. Once the mind is settled down, you will start seeing these in terms of these five aggregates. And as I said, this is a technical term that we'll be going into more detail probably tomorrow. You've got form, feeling, perceptions, fabrications, and consciousness. And he says you're clinging to these things. You say, I didn't know I had them. How am I clinging to them? They're actually processes that are going on in the mind all the time, and they're, again, the things that we feed off of. And so when you can see that you're feeding off these things that are causing suffering, you don't need to feed, that's when you can let them go. But there's several stages in the process. And then finally, the last big topic is going to be the Four Noble Truths, which is kind of overarches everything. It's there at the beginning, and it's also going to be there at the end. When you learn how to look at your experience totally in terms of the Four Noble Truths, and then follow the duties with regard to them. Because under the framework of the Four Noble Truths, you've got the five hindrances. Those are causes of suffering, and the duty there is to abandon them. But the seven factors for awakening, that's part of the path. Your duty there is to cultivate these qualities. The five clinging aggregates are the truth of suffering, and that's something you want to comprehend. So the Four Noble Truths basically give you the duties to do with regard to the other frameworks. So we're going to be kind of going backwards because we're doing the Four Noble Truths last. But it's good to keep them in mind from the very beginning, that these provide the framework that tell you what to do when you're dealing with a particular situation, either when something comes up or when you're out looking for something. This is what you should be looking for. This is how you should be dealing with it. So that's kind of an introduction to the weekend. Are there any questions before we plunge into the material? Yes?
Those three fabrications that you mentioned, there was
bodily, verbal, and mental.
So self-talk.
The self-talk is the verbal.
Okay. And did you say clinging was one of them?
No, we cling to these things. You can cling to the way you breathe, you cling to the way you talk to yourself, you can cling to the way you picture things to yourself. But these are all activities in which the second level of activity, which is the clinging, comes on top of them. And we go through the day and we don't pay much attention to how we're doing this. Like all the chatter that goes on in your mind. Sometimes you give some serious thought to it, other times you just kind of let it, whatever comes up. The Buddha said, that's why we suffer, all these things happen in ignorance. So we're trying to bring more attention to this and learn how to do these things more skillfully. The word ignorance for the Buddha, avijja, is actually the opposite of two things. It's the opposite of the word vijja, which has two meanings. Vijja means knowledge and it also means skill. You breathe in an unskillful way, you talk to yourself in an unskillful way, you perceive things in an unskillful way. And the important thing to notice is that you can change the way you breathe, the way you talk to yourself, the way you picture things to yourself. Does that answer your question?
Yes. Are those inclusive or are those three primary applications?
They're enough. Enough for the purpose of practice. I mean, there are lots of other ways in which we fabricate, but these are the three that the Buddha says will contribute to suffering. Yes?
I understand that the four foundations of mindfulness, the intention is to alleviate suffering. Mm-hmm. But there seems to be something, to me, so dramatically different between the first and the fourth set. The first, you're the foundation is the body breath, and we cultivate a kind of calm, so you can discern what's upsetting you. But you're kind of, you're meditating. I have trouble seeing the fourth one, it, like, it seems noisy. You know, how are you getting quiet? How are you discerning?
Okay, well, it's when you're trying to discern something in the quiet, you have to ask yourself some questions, right? And the question is, where is the suffering here? What am I doing? That's what the fourth frame of reference is actually giving you, a framework so you can ask those questions. Now, it's not, you're not going to be holding all the frameworks in your mind all the time, and a lot of times you're not going to be holding them, you know, explicitly, but they're implicit in the background, and they lead to the questions that you're going to be asking yourself around the suffering. Like when you start seeing things, and admittedly there's going to have to be some thinking. You can't just kind of chill out all your way to nirvana. You chill out for a bit and then you say, okay, now I've got to understand this, because there's something going on here that I still don't see. And Buddhist approach is kind of a problem-solving approach. You have to recognize that there's a problem, which a lot of people don't. They get the mind really quiet and say, I'm fine. Up to a point. But then begin to realize that this still goes up and down. There are days I can and days I can't get into concentration. Even when it's in concentration, it's like there's something eating away. So what are you going to do? You can either ignore that, or you can say, okay, let's, instead of just going just for the calm, let's try to figure this out. And these frameworks give you a series of approaches that you can apply. It's not like you're going to be carrying them all around in your mind all the time. But when you notice you've got a problem, say, okay, where does this fall? And you fall back on your background, on your framework. And where it gets noisy is sometimes especially when you see mindfulness interpreted as just noting what's coming up and labeling it as it's coming up. That gets very noisy. Oh, there's right effort. Oh, there's wrong effort. Oh, there's... that gets very noisy. But if you say, okay, I've got a problem here. I've got this framework. Let me see how this particular problem fits within the framework that I've got. And it doesn't take too much to learn these frameworks. There are just five of them. And they don't have that many of this. I mean, it's not like 300 things or something. It's like all the bones in the body. Or all those things you have to memorize as a psychotherapist. You know, where does this fit in that? What's the name of that big volume you have of disorders?
DSM.
Yes. DSM.
The DSM, yeah. I mean, it's not like having to keep the DSM in your head. Mm-hmm. All you have is four noble truths. Most, you have seven factors for waking. That's the biggest list. So when you're sitting and meditating, okay, and the mind's not settling down, you can ask yourself, okay, am I weak in any of these seven factors? What's lacking? You go down the list and, I haven't been getting any rapture out of my meditation for a while. Maybe I need some more rapture. It's kind of a checklist. And then you put the checklist aside and you work on the rapture. So it's not like there's a certain element of noise, but it's noise for the purpose of digging out the problem. Does that make sense? Yes.
Ajahn, I'm listening, and what's coming into my mind is these teachings, as you've been giving examples, are for when we are in meditation, and also when we're practicing off our cushion.
Right.
So I'm curious if you will be addressing both, or are we being asked to think about these things as it applies in our practice, and then it'll transfer into our lives, or?
No, we're going to be talking about both contexts, both day-to-day stuff, and as you said. Yes.
I think you had mentioned, Ajahn, the two of these lists in the fourth foundation were for developing concentration, is that correct?
Yes, and particularly the five hindrances and the seven factors for awakening.
And how Do the five hindrances contribute to concentration?
Well, just knowing about them and learning how to recognize them. So, okay, here's the enemy.
Okay.
Know your enemy.
It's certainly.
Because again, the Buddha's whole approach is a problem-solving approach. And part of the problem-solving approach is, one is identifying the problem. And once you got the problem, then you work with it. Mm-hmm. And so when you can't find, the mind is not settling down, you say, wait a minute, am I carrying something around from the course of the day? Something somebody said, something I saw, that's creating this either sensual desire or anger or whatever. Mm-hmm. And then there are teachings for how to deal with these various hindrances. We'll go through them. Yes?
My understanding so far is that we can use the breath as an anchor when we start drifting away or when we become caught up in something. Does that mean that when we do come back to the breath, that we can use the breath and manipulate the breath to calm ourselves?
Right.
Because I've also heard that we're just supposed to breathe sometimes and not control the breath. But it's okay to do that?
It's very okay, yes. Because if you tell yourself that you're not controlling the breath, then it goes underground. There's an intentional aspect to your breathing. And if you say, well, just breathe whatever way that puts some little functionary in the lower part of your nervous system, suddenly gets in charge. Whereas the boss up here says, I'm not doing anything. Which the boss may not be doing, but something inside you is there's an intentional element going in the way you breathe. So you might as well learn how to do it consciously. And a lot of times people say, well, as soon as I start turning my attention to the breath, it gets frozen, it gets hard, it gets whatever, okay. That's when you say, I've got to learn how to do this. How can I control it in a way that's effective? That takes some patience. But you find that as you get more sensitive, it digs up layers of the mind that you hadn't noticed before. Which is why it's such a good thing to be able to do. And just as you go through the day, if you can breathe through a lot of tension in 5 minutes, just by consciously saying, hold on, breathe, then you kind of wash it out of your system. It's good for you, it's good for the people around you.